Good morning. This is Northern Light for Monday, April 22nd. Happy Earth Day. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe.
State lawmakers and Governor Kathy Hochul passed a $237 million state budget over the weekend. We'll get a rundown just ahead.
Also, a major newspaper covering the Akwesasne Mohawk community has suspended publication in the face of financial stress. A conversation with the editor coming up.
We've received a lot of support, but there still has to be a lot of changes, like how to transfer the verbal support into actual business practice that can take us forward.
Also, in celebration of Earth Day, we'll take a walk and talk with Vermont poet David Cruz about how his writing connects him to nature, the environment, and a new season.
Spring has such a long legacy for poets. I actually, most of my writing, most of my composing of new poems actually happens on the hiking trail these days.
All that's coming up on Northern Light. Stick with us.
Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by CarComplaints.com, providing information about squeaks, bangs, flashing lights, odd smells, and other vehicle complaints online at CarComplaints.com, and by Adirondack Experience, the museum on Blue Mountain Lake, exploring people's connection to the Adirondacks with interactive exhibits and culturally rich connections. Reopening May 24th, the adkx.org.
This is Northern Light. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe. State lawmakers finished up the budget over the weekend, nearly 3 weeks after it was due. The $237 billion spending plan restores funding for school aid and includes a package to encourage the growth of affordable housing in New York. Karen DeWitt reports from Albany.
The Assembly stands adjourned.
The New York State Assembly voted on the final budget bill over the weekend, nearly 3 weeks after the April 1 deadline. The spending plan reverses Governor Kathy Hochul's proposal to change the way schools are funded. That would have resulted in half of the state's school districts receiving less money than they'd expected. Hochul dropped an unpopular plan to eliminate a provision known as Hold Harmless. That guarantees that no school receives less money than it did the previous year, after both majority party Democrats and minority party Republicans objected. The spending plan also includes a housing package that creates a new tax break for developers who include affordable housing in their projects, known as 485X. It also briefly revives a former tax break known as 421A that expired 2 years ago, so that some affordable housing projects in the pipeline can be built. The housing package also contains strengthened protections for tenants, though not as comprehensive as housing advocates and some progressive Democrats had wanted. Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins praised the agreement in remarks on the Senate floor.
It was beyond time to reach a housing deal that addressed head-on realities that families on the ground are facing. Although it may not be a silver bullet, it's an imperative step in the right direction.
Hochul, speaking on New York City public radio station WNYC's The Brian Lehrer Show earlier in the week, says while everyone did not get all they wanted, she still considers the housing deal a victory.
There's always controversy. Everybody wants what they think is the perfect deal, but this is so much more than they had, and I think I would take that as a win.
Hochul, who announced the budget agreement on April 15th, nearly a week before it was actually completed, also won a few key provisions that she'd been seeking. One will stiffen penalties for retail theft, which has become an increasing concern among New Yorkers, including strengthened penalties against assaulting a store worker. The Speaker of the Assembly, Carl Hastie, among others, had opposed the proposal but ultimately agreed to it. And she achieved a change in how a popular consumer-directed home health care program program for the chronically ill and people with disabilities is administered. It will allow the health department to contract with an outside entity to administer the program, cutting out around 350 locally based fiscal intermediaries. The provision was opposed by disabled groups and both Democrats and Republicans in the legislature. The GOP, which holds minority party status in both houses, criticized the Democrats' budget. Senate Minority Leader Robert Ort, who represents the Buffalo area, says the housing package falls short and does little for New Yorkers outside of New York City. And he says the new penalties against retail theft are not enough in light of crime issues in the state that he says has led to the deaths of three police officers this month.
We're failing, and you ask any New Yorker of all political stripes, and they would tell you, we are not doing enough on crime. This state is equally unsafe for more people today than it's ever been.
The budget also includes $2.4 billion to help deal with the state's migrant crisis and a crackdown on illegal cannabis shops that have sprung up as the state has been slow to license legal retailers for adult recreational marijuana. Lawmakers are now on break until May 6th when they return to finish the rest of the legislative session. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
SUNY Potsdam has inaugurated a new president to lead the school. According to North Country Now, Dr. Suzanne Smith comes to Potsdam from Georgia, where she served as provost of Georgia Southwestern State University since 2018. At an inauguration ceremony Friday, SUNY Chancellor John King and Potsdam Faculty Senate Chair Greg Gardner said her acceptance of the position at such a tumultuous time on campus shows her strong character. They also described her as compassionate. Her appointment comes as SUNY Potsdam officials are trying to close a $9 million deficit. University officials cut several degree programs and departments earlier this year.
An anchor media outlet in the Mohawk community of Akwesasne is facing financial troubles. Indian Time newspaper has suspended publication for a month as it restructures and prepares a new business plan. Its goal is to resume publication, at least online, in the next few weeks. Indian Time started in 1983. It was an offshoot of Akwesasne Notes, a groundbreaking indigenous-owned and written publication born from the American Indian movement of the 1970s. Editor Marjorie Gunyandonge Skitters told David Summerstein, Indian Time was born during a time of internal conflict in Akwesasne.
We were not reporting on ourselves. It was all mainstream media reporting on Native nations in Akwesasne and across the U.S. and Canada. The events that unfolded around 1980 prompted writers and artisans and business people to say, we need to come up with our own newspaper. We need to report locally on what's happening here, unbiased, true, and factual, and they went with it from there.
And so Indian Time has been going for more than 40 years now. You know, it's such a huge part of the community in Akwesasne, along with CKON, the radio station, really serving, you know, everybody across Akwesasne territory and beyond. It must have been a real shock to you, to everybody, when you had to suspend the paper for a couple weeks.
It is. It is. And, you know, like I'm an editor. I write. I take photographs. I proofread. I'm scanning media all day long, all weekend long. To me, it's heartbreaking to see that this is the position that we're in right now. It's very sad.
Yeah.
And I hear from, I have several, you know, connections in Cornwall, Potsdam, Canton, and we talk about the paper, and I've always heard such good compliments, and they always mention that, well, we just love how you cover the community, and you always shed a positive note on the community. And I think that's an important part of the paper, is the health and wellness of the community. And we've had some horrible and tragic events happen in Akwesasne. But it's important for the paper to take seriously the health and wellness of our community members by portraying them in a positive, inventive, and creative and innovative light. Indian Time also has a supplement that covers practically virtually anything you want to know about the Haudenosaunee. Our foods, our ceremonies, our government. And we have that. Indian Time created that years ago. And a few years ago, I was part of updating it. And it was really exciting to go through all of the information that we have in there on ourselves. We also are a vital part of the community as far as everybody's efforts to relearn our language. We offer a language lesson every week. It's there for everyone to use. It's always pertinent to what's going on, you know, seasonal. And we also have a culture corner. And we carry legends, works on the Great Law, works on Galileo. We have that and we offer that every week.
What has the reaction been from people around the community in Akwesasne?
We've received a lot of support, but there still has to be a lot of changes, like how to transfer that support, the verbal support of, I think you're doing well, I hope you don't close, into actual business practice that can take us forward.
Every outlet has sort of particular financial issues, but, you know, there is a sort of larger narrative of news outlets really struggling and laying off journalists and things like that. And it just makes me want to ask you about the importance of having independent journalism in Akwesasne.
I think it's vital. It's vital for us to cover the monthly meetings, for community members to be able to read something, independent, non-biased. To read something that isn't written by an employee of the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe or written by an employee of the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne. It's written independently. Mm-hmm. So as much as we're not a huge investigative journal, we are a community newspaper. We try to do our best to cover that.
Marjorie Gagnento-Gay-Skitters is the editor of the Indian Time newspaper based in Akwesasne. She spoke with David Summerstein, and you can help the paper with its financial troubles by subscribing at indiantime.net.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. It's 8:13. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Coming up, it's Earth Day and National Poetry Month, and we'll hear one poet's take on writing for a new season in just a few minutes here on Northern Light. This show is only possible because you, listeners, donate to support it. Thank you so much for a successful fundraiser. The station reached its $315,000 goal. You made it happen. You're incredible. This community is amazing. A huge thank you for being part of NCPR and Northern Light.
Pianist Adrian Carr in Plattsburgh. Northern Light is supported by Apothecary Chocolates, making gourmet chocolates by hand from all-natural herbs, botanicals, and tree syrups. ApothecaryChocolates.com.
Today is Earth Day, the day dedicated to celebrating our environment and the planet we live on. Groups throughout the North Country held events over the weekend and going into this week, including on many college campuses. At Clarkson University in Potsdam, students are planning a week of activities designed to get people thinking about climate change and environmentalism. Ella Weldy is a junior studying environmental engineering. She says Clarkson's Institute for a Sustainable Environment and its Sustainability Club have put together a schedule that has something for everyone.
And with the main theme being activities that have the opportunity to spark conversation, because I really think that conversation is where change starts. It's learning about these issues and becoming interested in them because you're realizing your peers and this other group of people are already super excited.
Weldy says the activities range from giving out free period products, making climate pledges with sidewalk chalk, to a documentary screening. She says the public is invited to many of the events, too, like a trail walk to identify local trees and an energy efficiency workshop.
I'm really hoping that the rest of the community can see what Clarkson is doing and maybe get excited about some of the research that's going on here and also get excited about like the climate crisis, because it's not just students that should be excited. It's really everyone, because this is everyone's problem.
Weldy says she hopes people walk away talking about adaptations they can make to be more environmentally sustainable. You can get more information about the Clarkson events on our website, ncpr.org.
For the first time, the federal government is regulating PFAS, chemicals in drinking water. PFAS are a class of man-made chemicals. They're key ingredients in everything from Teflon and waterproofing to pizza boxes and dental floss. Some of them have been found to have a probable link to cancer, thyroid disease, and birth defects. That's why the Environmental Protection Agency is now requiring local water providers test for PFAS and treat the water to remove them. That's 8 years after significant levels of PFAS chemicals were detected in New York and Hoosick Falls in Rensselaer County and in Fort Drum's water wells. That led to a $27 million project to build five new wells on base. The EPA says public water systems need to be testing for PFAS by 2027 and be able to treat them by 2029.
The Watertown City School District is using a new artificial intelligence-based threat detection software. It's called Lightspeed, and it monitors online activity on the district's devices and on phones using the district's Wi-Fi. The district superintendent told the Watertown Daily Times that the system is scanning for bullying and threats of self-harm. The school started using the software last week.
A cemetery in Potsdam is now offering a natural burial option. As Amy Fireazzle reports, it joins a few other locations across the region that are going green in the graveyard.
Natural burial is an alternative to traditional, more expensive, and more resource-heavy options, like being embalmed or cremated. All the materials involved are compostable.
There would be no metal, there would be no chemicals, there would be no vault.
That's John Omohundro, a member of Potsdam's Bayside Cemetery Association. It was recently approved by the state to offer natural burials.
Caskets are welcome, but they must be totally decomposable. And it is not even required. A person can be buried in a shroud.
Omohundro was the driving force behind the natural burial option. He says he was motivated by public interest.
We were having community members pestering us about, hey, there's this thing called natural burial. Why don't you do that? Why don't you do that?
And for financial reasons. Omohundro has served as the president and treasurer of the board and said that traditional cemeteries are struggling financially as burial practices and preferences change and more people choose cremation over caskets and mausoleums.
If we don't pay our bills, we would have to abandon the cemetery. So we needed new streams of income.
That's why Bayside has set aside two areas in the cemetery for natural burial. Each area has about 20 spots. He says they've been very popular so far.
And I expect to sell those soon and have to find some more. My hopes were that it would help us, and it is. So that's good.
Omohundro says the next step would be a larger natural burial area in the woods.
On this little small plot of land that used to be a garden. And it will be all natural burials, and it'll be surrounded by red pine trees, and there'll be nothing there but blueberry bushes, and it will be landscaped with flowers and taller grasses.
There are just a few places in our region that offer natural burials. They include the Keene Cemetery, which started offering them in 2022, and Spirit Sanctuary, a private natural burial ground in Essex. Amy Feiereisel, North Country Public Radio.
You're listening to Northern Lights right here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. In just a minute, how one poet prepares for a new season of hiking and writing outdoors. Then stick around after the show for Bird Note. We'll hear from the Nature Conservancy of Hawaii about connecting Hawaiian culture and tradition to conservation ecology. That's just ahead at 8:42. But first, how does a look at the weather for us?
Sunshine today, a high near 50, warmer tomorrow with some isolated showers, highs in the 60s, and then colder on Wednesday with a wintry mix possible, about a 20% chance of maybe some sleet and rain, highs mid-40s on Wednesday, and gradually milder temperatures later this week, highs near 50 with sunshine on Thursday and a high near 60 on Friday. Right now in Canton, sunshine 33 degrees.
For Vermont poet David Cruz, spring is the time for deepening the practice by reading and researching in preparation for the upcoming hiking and writing season. Cruz is an editor, writer, poet, and outdoor enthusiast. He got hooked on hiking in the Adirondacks. He's a 46er and regularly hikes the mountains and forests of the Northeast for inspiration.
We've asked David Cruz each season for the last 5 years to share a story and a poem. The New Jersey native has lived, worked, and created poetry in the North Country and Vermont as a writer of place. When he's not writing or hiking, he works on a Vermont vegetable farm. So in celebration of Earth Day and National Poetry Month, I caught up with David Cruz at Crown Point State Historic Site near the southern end of Lake Champlain, surrounded by Vermont's Green Mountains and the Adirondacks. While walking a muddy trail amidst bird song and brisk winds off the lake, we talked about how David Cruz's writing connects him to his love for nature, the environment, birding, history, and a new season.
Hello, I'm David Cruz. We are at Crown Point Historic Site, which is a little peninsula jutting north into Lake Champlain, mm-hmm. right between the two states where we both reside. And it's a beautiful day here in April. And, you know, we've got some robins here in the distance cuckooing away. And, nice spot.
When we were going to kind of get together, David, mm-hmm. you had suggested this is kind of a nice spot to walk and talk and share a poem and mm-hmm. and kind of take in the season. Spring for you as a poet and as somebody who works on a farm yeah. and is busy preparing for the growing season, what thoughts go through your head at this time of year?
You know, spring has such a long legacy for poets. There have been so many poems written about spring, and of course, April being also National Poetry Month, right? So I don't know. I mean, as I mentioned to you, I'm not on the mountaintops as much these days, given that it's mud season. And at the farm, we are filling greenhouses with lots of little plants. And our plant stand will be open in a few weeks. Shout out to Clearbrook Farm and my wonderful field mates. I actually, you know, most of my writing, most of my composing of new poems actually happens on the hiking trail these days. It's really quite incredible. I spend a lot of time at home revising, but when I'm actually composing something new, it's usually out in the woods. And I think there's just something about having my feet on the ground and those walking rhythms, you know, and I'm oftentimes there by myself, and I'm disconnected from so much of the busyness of life, right? And that's where these poems just sort of, I almost can't help but write mm-hmm. poems when I'm on the trail.
Did you have a poem you wanted to read or talk about?
I pulled a poem It's a poem I wrote years ago, part of a manuscript that I've since sort of tabled. And it's a poem about Alexander Wilson, the ornithologist from the early 19th century. It's actually a poem I've never read before for a live audience, so I'm very excited to kind of share it. So the poem talks about Alexander Wilson, and it mentions some of the bird species that are named after him. And you may be aware of this, Todd, because we've mentioned it before, but this country in particular is currently, there are organizations looking to rename bird species that have been named after people. You know, I think this is going to be a little bit of a difficult change for some people, for bird enthusiasts. Also, if you think about every field guide that's out there is suddenly outdated, right? And now we're going to have to change and update a lot of that. But as far as a progress socially, culturally, to help the activity of birding and being out in nature to make it more safe and equitable for all people, right? That's sort of a progress, right? That's an evolution, which, of course, I'm in full support of. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about this poem is that, and you know this about me too, I'm also a preservationist, and I think that's where ideas of balance come from. And in some ways, this poem, which is titled History Lessons, is in a way an act of balance too, and because you can still preserve the history, you could still preserve the narrative and where we've come from, while at the same time supporting a progress and a change into the future. The poem becomes the logging something in history and also returning us to where we came from as we move into whatever the future holds for us. Right. Yeah. All right. So the poem is titled History Lessons. Shortly after immigrating to America at the age of 28, Alexander Wilson served as a teacher at various schools in Kingsessing and Grays Ferry and studied during that time with writer and naturalist William Bartram, soon becoming the nation's foremost authority on birds. He was from the Scottish town of Paisley, and as a young adult, lived as a poor weaver and an undistinguished poet. Though during the years 1808 to 1813, he completed 8 volumes of American Ornithology, a colossal attempt to bring contributions in science to the forefront of American culture by cataloging 328 species sketched in outline and colored by hand, with a description of each bird in habitat and life history. His explorations in science engaged a literary sensibility, a man who believed the study of nature often elicited a response in the poetic faculties, and one time recorded a 1,200-mile foot journey to the Falls of Niagara in a romantic narrative poem published serially in the Philadelphia Portfolio from July 1809 through March 1810. 1810 was also the year of a chance encounter with a one John James Audubon, and it mattered little at the time these two men were the only well-known ornithologists living in the country, for Wilson left with few kind words to say of the man, which perhaps comes from a great contempt for greatness and its lofty pursuit. His work, too, part of a larger vision to challenge the human need to control nature, as he often criticized the urge to destroy the living world regardless of consequence. And so, the story goes, in 1808, when the city of Philadelphia continued to permit the capture and slaughter of thousands upon thousands of robins to satisfy, as was said, the genteel palates of the feigned and unassuming merchant class, Wilson wrote an anonymous letter citing the toxic nature of robin flesh due to their heavy diet of pokeberries, which he knew to be untrue. A little lie meant for the preservation of species. So in celebration of his life, we have Wilson's storm petrel and Wilson's plover, Wilson's phalarope and snipe, and the black-capped, bright yellow Wilson's warbler. He died of dysentery on the 23rd of August, 1813, at the age of 47, and was buried in Old Swedes Churchyard of Gloria D in the South Wark neighborhood, where now The nighttime sky illumines eternal in the radiant fire of a sprawling city. I've never read that poem before, but it always held a little bit of a charm for me. And here we have robins in the background singing, right? As if, what an audience.
You haven't read it publicly, but here's your audience. Right?
Yeah, yeah. What a nice spot.
Vermont poet David Cruz is an editor, writer, poet, and outdoor enthusiast. For the last 5 years, he's shared a favorite seasonal poem with us, and I am grateful. You'll find a link to his website and more of his poetry at ncpr.org. And that's it for Northern Light.
Lots of conversations for Earth Day today. Later this morning, how each presidential candidate is or isn't tackling climate change. That's on 1A between 10 and noon. Then this afternoon on Here and Now, meet one of the young people who sued the state of Montana over climate change and won. That's between 1 and 3 o'clock on Here and Now, right here on North Country Public Radio. Now back to news headlines from NPR.